I really thought this was funny. Why did you call it snooze instead of something like the...
Well, there were a number
new something else.
There are a number of alternate titles that I also enjoyed. One was the new and improved Yorker with a little carrot in there, kind of like an advertising product. But snooze was a decision by committee. My own preference is that I like it because it has a double O and a Z, and any title with a double O and a Z can't be all bad.
It's really incredible because it looks almost exactly what I would picture a best of the New Yorker magazine would look like, in right down to the typeface, the fonts there. Now, how did you duplicate these?
Well, I'll let a secret out of the bag and tell you that the text type is just a very close match. The headline type, I'll plead the fifth on in terms of my own ignorance of technological wonderment in the world of typesetting. I really know how they did it, but I'll never tell. Actually, I sat up late nights for the last year and a half doing it all by hand with a 00 repeatograph nib. Actually, we had incredibly large and loud arguments about whether or not subheads should be 18-point and the heads of what we categorize as talk pieces should be run in with ital and 18-point or 14-point. Where should we ape them? Where should we do something different? We wanted to retain the feel and look of the magazine and at the same time do what it was you said, make it look as if it were an anthology of New Yorker pieces rather than the magazine itself. You know, it had been our intent originally to do a facsimile parody. We had both, Alfred Gingold is the author of Items from Our Catalog, the L.L. Bean parody, and that spawned a sequel, and both of which did very, very well. And I was involved with a parody of Playboy and a parody of Cosmopolitan and a parody of Dr. Spock. And our experience was, do a copy of the original and knock it all off. We wanted to do parody ads, because the ads are so much a part of the New Yorker, and we wanted to do a magazine format so that it would be almost mistaken for the original. And for a variety of reasons, the most intense of which was budgetary, we were pushed into this accumulation, this historical format that increased our workload by a factor of about a skillion. I mean, we were going to do about 80 editorial pages, and now all of a sudden we were doing almost 300. And we really didn't know whether we could pull it off, and we called in virtually everyone we knew who was at least semi-literate and asked them if they could parody A.J. Liebling or if they could parody a cartoon style of Price. Or we went to the four corners of the earth to find parodists for a magazine about little old New York.
The cartoons are really incredible because they not only do they look like the New Yorker cartoons, but some of them could easily fit in the New Yorker, although some of them are a little more scatological than the New Yorker.
we tried to do that, and if anyone from the New Yorker is listening, we can give you a real good deal on second rights for those cartoons.
Yeah, some of these would fit in very nicely with the New Yorker. They are exactly what the New Yorker would include. Although there are some slight sexual relationships references, such as the one about the G spot that New Yorker may not put in, or the one about the man walking his dog and going past the tree, but the dog doesn't use the tree. I think the man does, as I recall. Mm-hmm. I don't know if New Yorker would go quite that far.
Well, we wanted to take it a little bit farther. We wanted to remain in voice and in tone and have the same look, but at the same time, we wanted to startle a little bit. And that's one reason we were hoping to appeal both to New Yorker readers and to people who weren't particularly familiar with the magazine or who'd only seen it once or twice in the dentist's office. we have found that there is an interest in the magazine from coast to coast. It's remarkable, but we get response from irate New Yorker readers in Kansas City and San Francisco and Milwaukee and Cleveland. And they're out there. They know their magazine, and they know that we've taken a few shots at it.
Yeah, in spite of its title, The New Yorker is really a national magazine.
Well, I think it is. I think it's really a repository of American letters for the past 60 years. I don't think there's anything else like it, at least on this side of the Atlantic, in terms of collecting contemporary writing. And they call it the cartoons drawings. They're a little bit too hoity-toity to refer to them as such a lowbrow title as cartoon. I like to call them cartoons.
Now, did you and Alfred Gingold write most of the material in this book?
Alfred and I wrote about two-thirds of it, and collaborators wrote the other third. We went after specific people to do specific people, and when we talked to, it was a lot like casting a show. We kind of found the best actor we could find and said, well, who do you want to do? And we had some marvelous takes on some very distinguished writers, and it's very interesting to see the reactions to writers parodied when those writers are really institutions. It seems like the piece we did on E.B. White was very
Well, I'm glad you did make it, because Workman people said that you were kind of like a matched set.
Like a salt and pepper shit.
That's right, that the two of you kind of had to
go together.
Like a horse and carriage. Or something like that, anyway.
That's right. You, how did each of you get this interest in The New Yorker to the degree that you just had to put a parody together?
Well, we both grew up with it, and it was something that was always in my house. And as a very little kid, I remember looking at the cartoons, and then I learned how to read, and then I read the cartoons, slowly as I grew older, I also began to read the articles. And then when I was about 15 or 16, I said, "Well, I'm not going to read these anymore. I'll just go back to reading the cartoons."
To me, and to, I think, to John, to a lot of people I know, The New Yorker is The New Yorker was my first idea of what it meant to be sophisticated and worldly and hip, I guess. I remember when I was a teenager, we always had it around. My sister would bring it home, and I'd look at the ads, all those wonderful vases and suits and watches and things, and the cartoons and the stories, eventually. It was just always kind of a part of, it was always in the background.
It was great to carry around if you wanted to look older.
Well, it's obvious that Snooze is a very affectionate portrait of The New Yorker, isn't it?
Well, we're glad you think so. We think so, although it must be said that we are occasionally followed in the night by men with elbow patches on their corduroy jackets, whom we suspect to be renegades from 43rd Street.
Well, in fact, William Shawn, he is also late, because there was a lot of traffic on 6th Avenue. He was walking up here to 52nd Street, but he should be here by about 4 o'clock to participate in this conversation, which I thought would be a treat. Have you talked directly to Mr. Shawn about this?
I dare say. Get him to speak right into the mic.
he's almost as reclusive as J.D. Salinger, who appears in Snooze.
He's J.D. Salinger's real estate agent.
Yeah.
It's hard to be that reclusive when you live in Manhattan. Somewhat easier when you live in New Hampshire.
Well, Garbo can do it.
Garbo can, but she has a lot of friends in her corner who apparently guard her secrecy. I guess Mr. Shawn does as well. Certainly, we haven't seen him.
No, I don't much think about he has ever conducted an interview, or at least not in recent years. Do you know of any?
No.
But I'm willing to talk to Mr. Shawn and as well to J.D. Salinger. If Mr. Salinger would like to come forward, the microphone is always open for him. We'll read the excerpt from Mr. Salinger's What are they, parodists? What are people who do parodies?
Writers looking for work.
Have you guys ever been in the New Yorker offices?
I once walked by there to kind of see what they looked like from the outside, to see if somebody that looked like Clark Gable was inside typing, and also to drop off some drawings, and then to pick up some drawings, and then to drop off some writing, and then to pick up some writing. And they do have the classiest rejection slips of any magazine that
yeah,
I've
but they don't have
been
the classiest
rejected by.
Offices.
No, the offices are really pretty blasé, run-of-the-mill, linoleumized.
I've heard their offices are very pokey. I've never been up there, and in fact, during putting the putting together of Snooze, I thought, well, I know where it is. Why don't I just go there and have a look? And I sort of didn't want to, because I'd heard that it was very, you know, all cut up into little cubicles and
it's
full
something
of,
out of the 1930s.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is what I gather, and certainly in a couple of the books, in Brendan Gill's book here at the New Yorker, he talks about all there are a lot of little quirks. I mean, apparently for years and years and years, the only way you could get from the 18th floor to the 19th floor, the 19th floor to the 20th, the only way you could get from one floor to the other was by an exterior fire stair. So you had to go outside the building.
Unless you knew someone to bribe.
Well, one interesting thing about the New Yorker as an entity, it doesn't seem to have changed either in its format or style or the quality of its work over all these years, has it?
Well, I think there's been one significant change over the last era, and that's a marked swing in not importance, but an accent from fiction to nonfiction. I think nonfiction is a lot more important than it once was. It also seems that it's not nearly as lighthearted, or as not that it was ever really lighthearted.
Well, now that's an interesting point. In fact, the New Yorker was originally intended to be much more of a humor magazine than it is today. Certainly, we looked at a bunch of old ones, and I just went to the library and looked at them all on microfilm and in fact in the 20s, it was the first issue was 1925. Everything in it is very, very short. Even the profiles are, I don't think there's anything in there that's longer than 1,500, 2,000 words. All little short pieces, not really fiction per se, but more like little humorous sketches. And that changed very quickly. I'd say I looked at some from 1928, 1930. And by then it already looked substantially the way it looks today. I mean, the mix was about the same. I think the political consciousness, which to some extent, John, it really was there from a long time back. Don't forget, in 1946, I think, they gave an entire issue over to John Hershey's book, Hiroshima, was originally printed in the New Yorker, published in the New Yorker. But certainly, I agree that the general feeling of the New Yorker was always light. Mm. A few little short stories, a few nonfiction pieces about some off-the-wall topic.
I think the literary stars, I mean, the writing stars of the magazine were novelists and short story writers, and now that's not as much the case when you think of the John McPhees and the Calvin Trillins. Or the Roger Angel.
Yeah, I suppose, but you could also say that there's John Updike, there's Ann yeah. Beattie, there's John Updike, there's Ann Beattie, there's
Raymond Carver, I believe,
yeah.
Publishing.
Yeah, Raymond Carver's published a few things, but I don't think you could. I don't think of him really as a New Yorker writer per se. He hasn't been nourished and sustained by the New Yorker. I mean, that's really, to my mind, and to be serious for just a brief moment, I mean, that's the real contribution of the New Yorker and why why their impact on American writing, why the New Yorker's impact on American writing is has been so powerful. And that's that they've really believed in their writers and believed in it with their checkbooks. I mean, I don't mean they've given out subsidies, but they've really brought writers along with long-term commitments to, I don't really know, I don't know what the business arrangements there are, but I know that there are writers who, the New Yorker will have a right of first refusal on anything that they do, or they will, in effect, advance money to
they
writers.
They have a funny title that they give to their writers for whom they have a right of first refusal. They call them staff writers, but they're really not on staff. They're paid by the piece. So they may get a guarantee, however, of some kind. But essentially, they're not a staff writer in that they are assigned by William Shawn to go out and cover these sorts of things. Because if the New Yorker doesn't like... The only reason I know this is that I talked to a number of New Yorker writers who publish books, and so I've done interviews with them. So if they happen to have a story that's rejected or an article that's rejected, they're free to sell it someplace else, and they do, or if they can.
Mm-hmm. But... As you were saying before, I think it's also quite remarkable that the New Yorker looks, except for the ads, which, you know, the cars now don't look like the cars in 1930. It looked exactly like this 50 years ago.
Real strong reason for doing a parody of the New Yorker. I mean, every other magazine and media piece seems to change its format and its look every season.
And that look is based on, the reason for that change is based on some sort of demographic study, you know, that if we make the headings this way, it will appeal to the kind of audience which is the audience we're trying to get. The New Yorker, you get the feeling, has just ended up looking the way it looks through a series of accidents. I mean, that somebody, they just... did it that way. Why are there two dots under every cartoon? I don't know. But
there are.
Yes.
There are in our book.
There are not?
In our book, there are.
Are there?
Yeah. There are in our book, and there are in The New Yorker.
Two dots over the cartoon.
Well, depends where it falls on the page. If the cartoon is flush on the bottom, then the dots will appear above the cartoon. Drawing. But we do know that there is a rule that they have for why those dots appear, where they do, and when they do, and in the number that they do.
They just won't tell us.
We were never able to figure it out, is what it is.
I noticed that Houghton Mifflin publishes a book called The Best American Short Stories of the Year, and this year, Raymond Carver, incidentally, was the editor of this year, and I believe there were either three or four stories out of the 19 stories from The New Yorker in this book, the largest percentage. But then it occurred to me that The New Yorker was really the only national publication published on a weekly basis that does significant amount of fiction.
I don't know. Cosmopolitan seems to have a lot of fiction in it on a monthly basis.
You think the quality is up to...
No, I was trying to come in there with a little joke.
Oh. Well, yes. No, Cosmopolitan does do fiction, but I wasn't...
And so do a lot of them. Esquire still does fiction, but sort of once a month they do one story.
Yeah,
or maybe two. I don't know, but not very much. Certainly, the New Yorker is the only magazine, I think, that's being put out now with a real serious commitment.
Not only that, it's
short fiction.
It can create stars. I think Tama Janowitz is she was in People magazine.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, her career took right off when
as
she
a
started.
Result of her stories being published in the New Yorker, and where else can a writer become a celebrity as quickly?
Well, I'm going to have to start publishing my stories in The New Yorker from now on.
Well, it's not a
good luck. Good luck to you.
Well, what happened? Were you guys sitting around one day and said, John said to Arnold, I just love The New Yorker. Let's do something. Did I say that right? Alfred, I'm sorry.
Actually,
sorry,
Alfred.
Take that sentence. Sorry,
Alfred,
this is going to be stringently edited.
Actually, Alfred said it to me. We both have a long and checkered history in human parody because we always come to work in camps.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred was the writer and creator of two L.L. Bean parodies called Items from Our Catalog, and I was involved with a Playboy parody, a Cosmopolitan parody, and a parody of Baby and Child Care by Dr. What was his name?
Dr. Bubba.
Dr. Bubba. So it seemed that after all that drollery, we wanted to tackle something that would come out and be really, really
Let's get right to it. We were trying to think of something that would sell, something we could sell and make a buck with, you know, and we kind of thought, well, what should we do, a parody of you know, the Scranton Yellow Pages? Should we do a parody of, a parody of Sports Illustrated, a parody of who knows what? And I thought that the New Yorker would be, I thought that the New Yorker was something that everybody, it's in every doctor's waiting room, it's in a whole lot of living rooms.
Did you think about doing a parody of BookBeat?
BookBeat? Well,
only with a drum machine.
No, but I certainly have now. I can tell you that.
As I was saying before, it's very, the genesis of the project is very interesting in that we started out trying to do a facsimile parody of a magazine. We wanted to include very splashy, glossy, four-color advertisement parodies and parodies of PBS series ads and to do something that would be humorously mistaken for the magazine itself. And we came away from that idea when, in fact, we couldn't sell it because of the expense in creating such a package. And it's far more expensive cover price than the New Yorker itself. And when we
but also there's another point here, which is that if you do, the interesting thing about the New Yorker is not only that they have all of this posh advertising, but that more than any other magazine, they have an extraordinary tradition and sense of, certainly more than any American magazine. I don't know about English ones or any other outside of this country. But they have an extraordinary tradition of writers and you know, the Algonquin Round Table, the O'Hara, Hershey, Salinger. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, borrowed in the course of preparing this a book, a three-volume set called, well, I don't remember what it was called, but it was one volume was the best of the New Yorker stories from 1925 to 40, the next was 40 to 50, and the next was 50 to 60. They were old trade paperbacks, and it was just remarkable. There's really hardly an American writer of note in that period who didn't publish something in the New Yorker. They weren't all New Yorker writers. You don't think of Thomas Wolfe as a New Yorker writer, but he published only The Dead Know Brooklyn. That short story was first appeared in the New Yorker. So did The Education of Hyman Kaplan. So did Irwin Shaw, the girls in their summer dresses. I mean, it just goes on and on. So that the limitation of doing a one-issue parody, it would restrict us to who's writing now, you know. And you know, there's a lot of argument about whether or not the New Yorker is living up to its great heritage, and is it still what it was, and blah blah blah. And I don't really want to get into that because it's depends on who you like, and
well, it also depends on your view of fiction today. But that's mm-hmm. also something that I don't think.
But what can't be denied is that their influence on American writing has been,
well,
just,
let's put
huge.
It this way, I think.
And we wanted to pick all that up. We wanted to parody not only the magazine, we wanted to get at the tradition.
I think when young writers start out in this country, their initial ambition is to get a story published in the New Yorker. If only I could do that, then I'd be a real writer. And since neither of us could do that, we published a parody.
Now, after you leave here, don't you think it would be worthwhile for you to take a copy and put it personally on the desk of Mr. Sean?
You know what it's like to get to that desk? I don't.
Well, you could try. Just say, here, I'm here to see Mr. Sean. I have a book for him. Can't you do that? Why don't you leave here 4 o'clock? He's probably still in the office.
We'll go up there with a six-pack and a ghetto blaster and see if he wants to boogie.
I understand he comes in the office about 11 and leaves around 3. Maybe you have missed him. So,
is that true?
That's what I read.
What have you been reading?
Well, I think I was reading... Oh, I think I read that in New York Magazine. I think they did a story about the changes.
Magazine.
They have a new managerial, you know,
yeah.
A new parent.
Oh, yes. They certainly
owner
have. And it's made... the first major changes in the layout of the New Yorker have happened in the last year in because of that. They're now selling half-page advertising. They're now having all those inserts and blow-in cards, those things that, you know, when you pick up the magazine, a little card falls out on your lap that tells you to subscribe to the New Yorker. You didn't used to find so many of those.
Yeah, we kind of like the magazine parody idea because it would have given us the opportunity to do their old-fashioned kind of sectional ads like mail-order widening pie service and a little noisemaker that when you open your refrigerator door it says oink, or maybe those are in the back of the New York Times magazine.
An oink machine doesn't sound
not
right.
In New York?
But no, they have little ads for, you know, barge tours of the Benelux nations and those little things. But another appealing thing is that it would have been a lot less writing.
This turns out to be a big book. Well, Workman has done this for you. They are a quirky publishing house. I enjoy doing Workman books because so many things are funny. In fact, yesterday I finally caught up with the 10 classics in 10 minutes.
Oh,
yes. I was
yes.
able to take little excerpts and use that. It's going to be back on Saturday. So now, where does one get a copy of Snooze?
You better get bookstores everywhere.
Even worse bookstores.
Even
and even
so-so bookstores.
Middle-of-the-range bookstores.
I suppose one can go directly to Mr. Workman, right, and ask Mr. Workman for a copy?
I suppose you could. I don't know if he'll have any, you know, on his person.
I think the New Yorker itself is very happy to direct people who query the magazine about where to buy a copy of Snooze.
Sure. I think the listener can probably just call the New Yorker and ask where to get a copy.
Absolutely.
Of Snooze. I think what I'll do is give
you're gonna
New
get
Yorker's
us into trouble.
Telephone number.
I think they'd get a real good lesson in 20th century invective.
Strange. I was talking to one of our account executives today. He had seen Snooze, and he said, "How do these guys get away with it?" I said, "Well, we have a First Amendment in this country." He said, "That's too close to the line." He said, "It seems to me New Yorker ought to be able to sue here because this is stealing their stuff." And I said, "No, I don't believe that's quite stealing their stuff. It's a parody. It's something different, isn't it?" So you certainly aren't afraid of any recriminations from Sean, are you?
No, it's been vetted. The whole thing has been vetted by lawyers.
The other interesting point is that it's wonderful that your account executive friend had this response to it. But if you look at the book at all, you'll find that we have a two-column format, whereas the magazine has a three-column format. So we've obviously done something to make somebody mistake it for the original, and yet it's completely different.
Well, it's not completely different, but it's certainly different. I mean, what is remarkable about it, I think, now that I've had a chance to look at it for a month, is that it really, in a lot of ways, such as those John just mentioned, is not at all like the New Yorker. It isn't, for example, the same typeface that the New Yorker uses because no one can get that typeface. But it's pretty close.
And of course, one thing that it does that the New Yorker probably wouldn't do, there's a picture of a jock strap on page 95.
You don't see many of those in the New Yorker.
No.
Not even in the ads.
That's right. Well, you guys are fun to talk to. I'm going to look this broadcast does not go out in this forum, so I take it and integrate the tape and use my own comments and so forth. So I'm going to have fun taking this and integrating it with my interview with Mr. Sean.
Are you going to make it sound like we're talking to him?
Well, we're not allowed to do that.
Bill Baby, loved your magazine. Yeah. Fab. Let's have lunch sometime.
Well, this is a journalistic endeavor, so no, we have to make it sound like real journalism. So I'm glad you did make it, even though it was hell getting here from Prospect Park, is it?
Park Slope.
Well, that's even worse.
It's a nice place to visit. Unfortunately, I live there.
I want to thank both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for waiting.
Hang on one second.